right? So for them, there's a much bigger benefit to that, right? It's helpful to do that. What is that noise?
That's my phone ringing. Hang on.
That's your ringtone?
That is adorable.
What is that? It sounds like seaside music.
And he gets up running.
He had such a, like, an opinionated walk towards the phone.
This might be the first time I ever wish the show was a video show, because all the listeners missed out on him popping out of his chair. It's the fastest I've ever seen him run.
This is a video show. We got to do this as a video show.
Everyone, and welcome to episode 77, all of the sevens, the 77 of Bad Voltage. We don't have Brian for the intro today, unfortunately. He had to take off, but we do have him on the show, you'll be pleased to hear. And we're going to kick off. We've got two really meaty segments. The first one we're going to talk about today is going to be about open hardware. Like, when is the right time to open hardware? Should everybody open hardware? What's the value to the consumer? What's the value to the business? We're going to get into that in response to a very interesting question from one of our listeners.
And we're going to talk about what the hell Google's policy is on chat apps. We'd like to ask Google themselves, but we couldn't decide which of the 19 chat channels they currently operate to ask them on. So instead, we're going to ask one another and you, the community, what the hell are Google doing and why?
And now, Bad Voltage.
Those of you who've been around for a while will remember a world in which there were a bunch of incompatible chat networks, right? You had AIM doing Oscar, and you had ICQ, and you had MSN Messenger, and all that kind of thing. It was all terribly frustrating for the free software world and for everybody who had friends who were on some other network and had to use their terrible messenger. But for a few years, at least, that kind of got solved there in the middle. But
how? How was it solved?
Well, yeah. Do you not remember, sort of in the middle of the 2000s or whatever, there didn't seem to be this incompatible problem. I didn't find myself, certainly, spending a bunch of time saying, oh, well, I can't talk to you because we're on a different network.
I think that's because you started using proprietary software.
Well, no, but
yeah, for the rest of us, it got solved for none of the years, for the record.
It got solved. Right. But this is not a proprietary software thing. If I was happy to use proprietary software, I'd still have had to use AIM and MSN and ICQ and. Right.
Yes.
But now it seems to have picked up again with a bunch of incompatible proprietary networks, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, G-Talk, whatever. Interestingly, Google appear to have taken the bull by the horns here and decided they're going to solve the problem of having loads of incompatible chat networks, which they don't own, by having loads of incompatible chat networks, all of which they own. So you've got G-Talk, Hangouts, which is sort of G-Talk and sort of not. You've got Allo, you've got Duo. Are all these things, they don't appear to be the same. If you can't talk to Allo people with your Hangouts app or the Hangouts app on the web, and Allo doesn't seem to exist on the web, and G-Talk was XMPP and now it isn't. And what the hell is going on? I mean, what is their plan? Do they have a plan?
So for listeners,
how are they going to do anything other than confuse the shit out of everybody?
So for listeners that may not be as familiar with the Google ecosystem of chat apps, which is an asinine thing to even have to say, I don't think you did it justice just how ridiculous the current situation is. So for those of you not familiar, let me just give you a quick overview, and this is what I could find currently. Right, there's Allo, which is their quote-unquote smart messaging app, which has that, I think, creepy smart replay thing where they try to guess what you would have said and suggest that you say it. I'll take care of my own responses, thank you. But that does no Google Voice integration. It only supports one device. So if you have an Android tablet and an Android phone, you can't use it on both. Whatever product manager let that out of the building, that's not even MVP. That's a joke. There's no desktop app. You can't set it as your default SMS app because it doesn't support it. So then they also at the same time released Duo, which is quote unquote, the tagline for it is a video calling app for everyone, where their definition of everyone means people who don't use a desktop. So not everyone. And then you have Hangouts, which can be used for SMS, although they removed the one of the highly touted features, which was the merged SMS. And they just changed the layout to make it terrible on desktop. But it does have Google Voice integration, but only if you're in the US. And then for some reason, when they released Duo, they also added video messages to Hangouts, but not video chat. And while they did that, they killed Hangouts on Air, because they're seemingly moving Hangouts more to the business side. But then if you get an Android phone, you get Android Messenger, which does some voice, I think, and definitely text. And then there's Google Voice, which does text and voice. And they still have Google Talk, which does IM, and they added voice to, and they have Spaces and Fi. That's all Google products currently supported.
And now, to be clear, and with the Google Voice side of things, half of the Google Voice functionality is only functional from within Hangouts, and the other half is only functional from within a Google Voice website because no other clients currently function. It's ridiculous.
Additionally to that, Google Voice is only functional in the United States of America to boot.
Yes. So meanwhile,
I don't know what the problem is. We make fun of
Jennifer using a Mac. They've had iMessenger as a unified experience since 2011.
Yes. Right.
I mean, there is no doubt in my mind. Someone would have to be bonkers to suggest that this is the optimal outcome. I mean, it is ludicrous. I mean, the thing that you touched on earlier on, Jeremy, about the product management, this to me seems like something that should be gated at some point at the company, where somebody says, okay, what's our overall vision when it comes to messaging or communication? And this has got to be reduced much, much like narrower, is that there's fewer options. I could understand the principle of having a video app and a messaging app, like a text messaging app and a video app, to use a poor comparison, Slack versus Google Hangouts. I could get that. But to have this multitude of different apps that kind of blend together blend functionality in different areas, it's just ridiculously confusing. And given the fact that they've just like announced the Pixel and Google are getting much more integrated into the hardware game, this is only going to confuse consumers when they're, you know, particularly people coming from the iPhone, right?
Yeah. And I think one of the worst parts about it is none of them are good.
Yes. No, that is true. Yeah. Well, here's the thing. If we're looking at all of these things, I think we have to, since we're all obviously confused about it, I think the only way to figure it out is to assume that one of the richest companies on Earth, run by some of the richest people on Earth, have a slight clue about what their endgame strategy is. So if we assume that they do in fact know what their endgame strategy is, that means that the entire barrage of stinky, awful mess that Jeremy described to us is on purpose. So what could it possibly be for? Like, what is the end game? I'm just as confused as Stuart is. It seems confusing. I mean, from one perspective, I have the, you know, the Google wants to spy on us more thing, where I just don't use those sorts of Google chat networks anymore. So I just want to tell everyone to avoid it. But even if you're trying to be involved in the Google ecosystem, I don't know what their strategy is. It doesn't make any sense. But clearly, they think they have one.
I don't know that they do. I think they have individual departments. Yeah. Trying right. to each vie exactly. for being the product for messaging and competing against each other, and none of them doing a good enough job to knock the other ones off. So it's just...
It smacks to me that Google is operating its business kind of like a lot of big companies, where a department is like an individual startup within a business. And what's happening is lots of different departments are building interesting things, which is cool, and companies can innovate and get lots of like press announcements, whatever else. But then you lose sight of the overall consistent vision, which is particularly important, I'd say, to Google, where Google is by definition a suite of services, right?
No, it's Gmail. Google is by definition an advertising and marketing research company.
Well, no, I agree that that's their revenue stream, but the consumer,
and that's the majority of their products.
The consumer,
well,
in the context of Android.
Right. It's a suite of services. Point, yeah. It's Gmail, it's Maps, it's Hangouts, it's all this kind of stuff.
Right. So for the purposes
of
marketing.
Exposing to those, Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
Android only exists for the purpose of collecting data for marketing purposes.
No one is denying the fact
I'm just saying that must be together for that purpose, right?
Yeah, somehow. I agree, but that's beside the point. What we're talking about is messaging, right?
No, that's what I'm talking about. The messaging thing.
No one's denying the fact that they're an advertising company, they're a marketing company, and that's how they're building these things to derive advertising revenue. No one's denying that for a second. All I'm saying is that I suspect what's happening here is that further up the chain in Google, there isn't that function that is basically making the decision that you provide a consistent vision, a consistent offering.
Okay, so
what's happening is you get fragmentation.
I understand the argument that they're doing a kind of an internal competition, internal market, right? Because some companies do that, but Google don't do it with anything else. Right, it's not like we're seeing two different mobile operating systems or anything like that. I mean, basically, I want to say, what is your chat client? Well, one, what is your chat client? Two, why haven't the rest gone away? Three, who's behind all this shit? And four, what is his fucking problem?
They have definitely done it in the past. I think in the past, though, they've created the products internally and maybe not released them to the level that they've released all of these. They've definitely
that
had
I
two.
Can believe.
Right, so this is just a case of all of them making it out the door in a more public way. I still don't understand why Hangouts isn't nearly as good as iMessage, because it's been out, what, they released it in 2013. They've had 3 years for something that shouldn't be that difficult to do, I wouldn't think. I mean, Ak, you use Android, correct?
Yes.
Jono, you use Android, correct?
Yep.
And you don't have a cell phone, Brian, but you use Android on your tablet?
Yeah, kind of, sort of. Yeah,
Do any of you use Allo, Duo, Hangouts, or Android Messenger at all?
Nope.
I use Hangouts. Not none of the rest.
Yeah, I the only time I ever boot up any of that stuff is to talk to you guys, because it's just so astoundingly insecure. But so no.
And I don't use any of the four either. So I used to use Hangouts, but now certainly not on Android. I use Hangouts on the desktop, but
right.
So I use none of the apps. Yep. So between all four of us, not one of us uses one of the apps.
The only thing I use Google services. I use Hangouts and GChat. Those are the only two. And they've been around for ages.
Right.
I don't know whether that's because I'm a curmudgeon.
Maybe.
But I don't see a need to use the other
curmudgeon.
Ones,
so. I'm a curmudgeon sometimes. Sometimes the kids get on your lawn and you got to yell at them. You're like, get off the damned lawn.
This situation makes me wish they'd bring back Google Buzz.
No, nobody.
They need to bring back Wave so I can talk about this.
Go home, Gutsy. Yeah. You've been drinking.
Talk your way. No, I think Jeremy's point from earlier is the key one here. A bunch of the new things feel like they're half finished. I'm quite prepared to believe that internally at Google, there's a big competition and people are building rival products, and then someone, you know, says this is the thing we're going to do and we're not going to do the rest. No problem with that. But it feels like a bunch of teams have built separate things and then they all got released. And it's not like they snuck out onto a GitHub repository. This stuff was on stage at I.O.
Yeah.
Right?
It's planned. It is,
I don't
from
think it
the,
is.
It is approved from the executive level. Otherwise, it does not make it to the stage.
Yeah.
So therefore, in order for this to make it to the stage, it has to serve a revenue-generating purpose, which means for Google, it has to do something in relation to advertising revenue. So it just has to, because they don't do anything else. That's all they do.
But what's interesting to me is that it seems like, and maybe I'm just looking at things through rose-colored glasses, but like years ago, Google would start out with, like, they bring something out new. Like, so they brought out Gmail, for example. And Gmail was a lot more simplistic back then than it is today. And then they'd gradually iterate and iterate and iterate. To me, the big thing where I was disappointed in Google here in terms of the cleanliness of their products, not in terms of the advertiser, that kind of stuff, just in terms of the user experience, was, you know, when they brought out Hangouts, everybody loved Hangouts because it was genuinely new, it was easy, it was accessible to a lot of people, right? And then they brought out Hangouts and Air, and that was really cool. It meant that people could do these live streams. And like, for example, we used them extensively in Ubuntu, and it was fantastic for us, just as one tiny example. Yeah. And then they got rid of Hangouts on Air, and they made it YouTube Live, which I assumed they were basically rebranding Hangouts on Air, and they were just putting it within YouTube, which I think would make some sense because the YouTube brand is pretty popular. But no, they're completely different. And a good example of this was a few weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I emceed this GitLab live broadcast thing, right? And when I suggested that they did this, I originally said, hey, just do a Hangout on it. Dead simple. But no, moving it over to YouTube Live was in itself, because Hangouts on Air stopped existing, I thought, YouTube Live is going to be just as simple. Yeah. It's going to be fairly similar, maybe a bit different, completely different. Yeah. To the point where GitLab ended up using a completely different provider. So it's like, to me, that's just poor product management.
Yeah.
It starts and ends at poor product management.
What they did was they had a thing, Hangouts on Air. They built something they considered to be better for whatever criteria they chose. But the point was they killed the old one and made you use the new one. This is like Canadians will know about this, right? They've got they've got $1 coins. The same as you have in the States, Susan B. Anthony dollars.
Is that the loonies?
The toonies are $2 coin.
Toonies are $2 coin. And they took off and they're fine, not a problem, because they killed the dollar bill when they did it, right? The reason you've got dollar coins there and everyone hates them is because you won't kill the dollar bill at the same time, right? Similar kind of example. You say, okay, I mean, you might not like YouTube Live and you might not appreciate the reasons they've done it, but you're not confused about which to use. At the moment, if I said, okay, I want to chat to one of you guys, how would I do it? I'd have to pick between WhatsApp or Telegram whatever, you know. But Matrix, Signal, whatever the thing is. But now if I think I want to chat to you, I know you've got Google accounts, I still don't know how to get a message to you. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. It is. It's because like when I think about the Google services, there's one calendar. It's Google Calendar. There's one email. There's Gmail. There's one video upload service. There's YouTube. And now there's like, what, three or four different chat things. So it's just not clear anymore. And I don't understand. So we obviously all think that there's a problem here.
Yes.
What's the solution to it?
Pack
it in.
I actually don't think that there is a problem here. Like I mean, if we're talking about the grand ecosystem of the ways in which we communicate and the different protocols and whatnot, then yeah, there's an issue there because there's way too much and communicating with people is a pain in the ass sometimes. But from Google's point of view, I don't know that there is a problem because I don't know what their end game is. All I know is they're an advertising company that now has like eight different ways of having chat applications out there, and I don't know what their end game is. So
When I said, remember when I said in the introduction, there are a bunch of incompatible chat networks and Google has decided to solve this problem by having a bunch of incompatible chat networks, all of which they own. That was a joke. You're suggesting that's the model.
No, I'm suggesting not the models to be emulated. No, don't get me wrong here. I'm just saying I don't know what Google's plan here is. Clearly, they put a ton of money and resources and fanfare behind a number of these newer chat networks that Google is releasing.
Yeah.
So why are they doing that? That is signed off at on the executive level. So therefore, at some level, the executives looked at it and said, you know what? This is the right way to go. It may be that it's a temporary thing. Maybe they're hedging their bets to see which one people like more. Maybe they're going to axe all of them but one soon. Maybe it's some grand plan to try and I do some social engineering project. I don't know. The Google guys are crazy. I just don't know how to evaluate success here because I don't understand what they're going for.
I can tell you what I think. I think they're too close to the product. I think if you went to some manager who owns the division in which all this stuff lives at Google and you said to him or her, what's the plan here? They would say, no, you see, Duo and Allo and Hangouts, they're not the same thing. They're not even competing in the same area. One of them is an instant messaging app which has direct replies and helps you craft a reply by automatically dragging in data. Another so one creepy. Is a video chat app. And then a third one is just for talking to people and occasionally having a video call. Completely different. And you'd be like, no, from the outside world, I'm prepared for them to justify that they're completely different, but they haven't done so. I'm not sure they even could do.
I think the problems are slightly different.
I bet you they think they're different.
You said him or her as if these are all under the same product manager, and my guess is they're not.
Yeah,
and
probably
that's
not.
Part someone of the bigger
has
problem.
To be. Someone has to be in charge of all of it. There's got to be a message.
I would guess Ellen and Duel are under the Android team, and Hangouts is probably not. And internally, Google employees don't like Hangouts. I think it's part of the problem. I think the answer is making Hangouts better, but Google internally doesn't seem to like Hangouts. So I think whoever's in charge of that team isn't driving the necessary publicity within the company to get the resources they need to make it better, and the people driving Allo and Duo are fracturing their own experience.
Here's a possibly analogous thing. I don't know much about the messaging side of things, but I do know a reasonable amount about the website, the Chrome team. And there have been a few points in the past where, you know, in order to make Chrome do something, it required Android platform support, right? And all of us sitting in various meetings or at conferences or whatever in the bar afterwards saying, well, you know, you're the Chrome team. Can't you just walk down the corridor and bang on the Android team's door and say, do this, right? And it turned out it's a much more fractious and much more adversarial relationship than I was originally thinking. So when Android came out with instant apps, which is the idea that you could just pick an app by icon and then it downloads it and runs it on the fly, which has always been one of the big things we've always trumpeted about the web, is you don't need to have anything.
I have to pause you for a second, Stuart. Stuart, you can continue. I just want to point out to everyone that they just heard a Hangout message received ding coming from one of my three co-hosts, which I think is funny in the session that where we're talking about
that
this.
That was me. Erica is asking if there's something in my office.
Via Hangouts. All right, Stuart, back
right.
to it.
So, Android instant apps, one of the big things that the web always got trumpeted for was, you know, you can just pick a thing and you're there and it loads, right? You don't have to pre-install stuff like you do with apps. Android comes out with instant apps, which is a way of saying, no, you see, you don't need that on the web because we can do that on the platform too. And just watching the Chrome team, you can see them going, oh, blimey, they're fighting back against that. And on the one hand, I was thinking, yeah, God, we must strive for this as the web. On the other hand, I thought, aren't you both the same company, though? This seems
they're really
weird,
not.
But they're really not. The Chrome team and the Android team, if they were in genuinely different companies and genuinely different things, they'd have the same relationship, I think. And this, I think, is the same kind of, you know, it's much more divided up internally inside Google than you'd necessarily think by the fact that they're all the same company.
Yes.
What's going to be interesting in my mind is when Google announced the Pixel, it suggested that they want to get much more opinionated about hardware, right? And I'm curious to see, I mean, I don't want to derail this to a question about what's going to happen in Android with all these different Android manufacturers.
Yeah.
But one of the things that was interesting about that announcement is that the Android that they ship on the Pixel apparently is a bit different to the Android that's shipping on on some of the other devices, apart from the fact that it doesn't have all the bloatware and whatever else. But it's not just going to be vanilla Android. And traditionally, it's been vanilla Android. And I'm curious to see whether Google are going to play, like, they've been balancing this delicate kind of thing with Android where Google make their own services and they own them and they run them and they're in charge of them. But with Android, it's this ecosystem, of course, where Samsung and Sony and other people are involved. And I'm curious to see that I suspect there's a tension internally with Google between them being an ecosystem company where they have lots of different offerings, lots of different services, potentially competing with each other, and the one true Google way. And it seems like this chat situation is more of the ecosystem thing where you have different things that do different things and they connect in different ways or the similar ways versus the like calendar, Gmail. You only get one version of that. There's not multiple versions of that. So I wonder whether there's an internal tension going on that's causing this lack of clarity for the rest of us who are looking in.
That sounds like a segment.
Yeah.
It is, yeah.
I understand what you're saying, but if you want to be an ecosystem company, you're meant to foster an ecosystem, not build it all yourself.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree. I would say that they've fostered an ecosystem. I wouldn't actually take that back. Carry on.
Yeah, take it back, man.
I was going to say the Android ecosystem, but Google built Android.
Yeah. So as we're wrapping up here, with the fact that Google has 8 chat apps alone, do we need to now update Zelensky's law from every program attempts to expand until it can read mail to every program attempts to expand until it's a chat client? Because it sure seems like it.
Or a
social media client. I haven't heard that reference in forever. Thank you for doing that, Jeremy.
We shall anoint this Garcia's Law.
So we recently got an email from Kyle, who is one of the founders of OpenMYR, which is an open source hardware company who are launching a Kickstarter. And we thought it was interesting enough to turn a segment into it. So to intro it, I'm going to read part of the email that he gave, and then we'll kick it off from there. So it says, I'm the founder of a startup called OpenMYR. We have been developing open source Wi-Fi motors for people of all skill levels. Our source code is already on GitHub under the MIT OHL license, which is the open hardware license. Right now, we are preparing to launch a Kickstarter. If our board designs are easy enough to find that a simple Google search could uncover them, then our hypothetical competitor could save a month or more of hard work and be that much faster at reaching market. After talking about the issue internally, we decided to keep our hardware designs on GitHub, but we would like your opinion. Do you think making source files harder to get, or even making them not open source, until delivery would be disingenuous, or would you have kept them open like we did?
That's a really hard one.
So my
particular take on this is that the business inclination is to keep it secret until you launch. That's just the gut reaction inclination that I think most business people are going to have. And I think that that's bass-ackwards stupid. And that's the kind of decision I probably would have made, 5 or 10 years ago. I think that opening it early provides more buzz around everything. So you start talking about it open early, you get the schematics out there early, even if they're not finalized, you start working with technology journalists and bloggers and whatnot early, get them excited about it, get them looking at it, get them giving feedback on it, get the community involved to do some of your engineering work for you. That's always handy. I think there's just too many benefits to not do it that way. I think though most companies would say, let's keep it secret until launch though.
I would say yes and no, with what you just said, Brian. I think we'd all agree that open source hardware and the more open source hardware there is the better. However, from the companies that I've worked with that have done open source hardware, it's really hard to do it well. And I think it really depends on the value of open source hardware to your punters, right? So to provide an example,
yes, please.
So to provide an example, with a company, I've worked with two or three companies who've done open source hardware, and one of the things that they found in all of these cases is you get a very, very limited set of contributions from the community, because most people just don't have the equipment set up to kind of iterate and work on open source hardware.
Most definitely.
So by definition, it's an expensive proposition to provide open source hardware, and you might get limited benefits. However, with some of these companies, the kind of people who are their customers are interested in open source hardware, right? So for them, there's a much bigger benefit to that, right? It's helpful to do that. What is that noise?
That's my phone ringing. Hang on.
That's your ringtone?
That is adorable.
What is that? It sounds like seaside music.
And he gets up running.
He had such an opinionated walk towards the phone.
This might be the first time I ever wish the show was a video show, because all the listeners missed out on him popping out of his chair.
This is a video show. We gotta do this as a video show.
He just walked this, like, Jack has this show, Paw Patrol. He walked like the mayor of the bad town in Paw Patrol to come and pick up. Hey, Ak.
How far away
was your phone? Wow.
It was plugged in on the other side of the room, which is why I didn't think about turning it to silent mode before I started.
So the real question is, was that an allo message or a duo message?
It was neither. That was actually an actual phone call. Right. So
wow. Rock out like it's 1995. So I think if you're a company that, if your audience, for example, is building like homebrew drones or homebrew computers, stuff like that, open hardware is just a logical thing because your audience is interested in that. But I would say for companies where your audience are just regular consumers or something like that, it's probably not going to be worth it. The competitors stealing your designs thing strikes me again as dependent on the company, because I suspect the hardware designs are generally so specific, with the exception of things like standardized racking systems, like with the Open Compute Project, that most competitors probably won't necessarily see a lot of value in taking it. Like, open source is much more generally applicable to different software stacks than open hardware. So I think a lot of it really depends on what you're doing.
Yeah. I think, you know, especially in the hardware space too, people iterate on hardware, especially in Asia, so quickly that if you're doing something simple, they won't have saved a month. They'll save a day, and that's not going to do anything for you.
Yeah.
Exactly. On the drone side of more complicated things, it's a different story. But this is just as a component, I think it's a different story.
You know, looking at it realistically, though, there's real benefit in giving your competitors a leg up with a little bit of a head start with some open source hardware. Like, back probably, I don't know, 15 years or so ago, I was working on this project that was this this classroom wireless that communicated over RF signal, little custom hardware board that let kids take tests that, you know, wirelessly beamed the results back to this little base station that we built. And we had That's this cool little thing. So it was a cool little digital test taking system. This was, you know, 15 years ago, so all the cheap hardware that could have just done that nowadays. And we had to develop it all realistically, really from scratch. Whereas if we could have looked out there and seen something somewhat similar, just kind of adjacent to what we were doing, that was open, and we could have looked at the specs for it, we would have so quickly contacted whatever company or project or people were behind that, tried to work with them, tried to give them work to help us to make it and to kind of pull that all together. It would have saved us time. It would have saved us money. It would have given the company who made it originally more work. Like, it would have been great all around. And so even for the scenarios where it's really specific hardware, because that was a very specific thing, I think there's still a profound benefit in it. And I can't think of a single scenario where that wouldn't be beneficial. I'm sure there is one. I just can't think of a scenario, a type of a piece of hardware to build where you've just got to keep it secret. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. I can't think of where that would be beneficial to the company building it, the other people competing with it, or the consumers. Like, I can't see anyone benefiting from any of that, except for maybe, like, I don't know, the NSA, if they want to make sure there's a special custom chip to hack into a computer or something like that. But outside of that really weird scenario, I can't think of it.
So just to add a little bit onto what you said about getting kind of buzz around the product, I think what a lot of people don't realize is a competitor taking our idea sounds like something that's really should be a concern. In most cases, especially for small projects, someone stealing your idea is not the issue. Your idea getting enough support to be a viable product is a much, much, much bigger issue. That's a much bigger threat. So getting extra getting more people to support a small project is way more important than someone stealing the idea, in my experience.
Way more.
The distinction here, I agree with you, but the distinction here is not that they're worried about someone stealing their idea. They're worried about someone putting exactly the same product on the market without having to pay for all the research. This is not stealing the idea. This is stealing the thing itself, right? Cory Doctorow may say, no, you see, I can put my books out there and loads of people read them and it gets the word out. And it does. But I'm not convinced it works if you're me rather than Cory Doctorow or Neil Gaiman or someone like that, right? And this is the same thing. The thing they're worried about, I mean, is precisely, they say, here is our thing. It's a new thing, right? But we put it on the market. Someone just beats us to market with it, which is much easier if they don't have to do anything other than take the hardware specs and give it to the factory next door.
That's not how it works, though. No, it's totally not.
At the rate at which Chinese factories can now replicate hardware, the idea is what's important. Redesigning that board over there happens so quickly.
But if you've checked your schematics into GitHub right now, and if the thought is that it's truly ready, like those schematics are ready to go right over here to a shop to get up and running and cranking it out, what's stopping you from doing that at that point, right? So realistically, you haven't given anyone an advantage over what you already have. You just haven't. And the reality is there are a million things to think about when producing even a simple PCB inside a simple plastic enclosure. There's a million things to think about logistics-wise, shipping, sourcing of parts, everything. Even if you're doing it in what seems like a turnkey Chinese factory that you're doing it on the cheap, there's still a ton of things to figure out. You're probably going to need to fly to Chengdu and sit down with someone for at least a day to get up and running on anything other than, you know, 3D printing three or four, you know, units at a time. So there's a ton of work there to do. It's not like someone can just come along, grab the schematics and go, aha, I've got a business now, wee, and run off and they're all rocking out. You can't do it.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's say I accept that. I'm not 100% convinced I do, but let's say I do. This is a fundamental shift in the argument we're making, because it used to be you should open source stuff because you can build a community around it and because it's ethically the right thing to do and so on. And now we're basically shifting to, well, you're going to get copied anyway, so you might as well. That's such a council of despair.
Though. You're talking about two different... Open source hardware and open source software are fundamentally always going to be a little bit different. The ethical part of it goes to both sides. The other part of it doesn't.
Well, I would break it down into the benefits and the risks of open sourcing your hardware. I think, to Brian's point, the likelihood of someone just making a direct replica of it, I just think is unlikely. Apart from the logistical elements of building that thing, I think that from a business perspective, if something's already out there, why would you just go and immediately copy it? Now, I think that it's different in China because the Chinese will take something in the Western market and then they will sell it in the Chinese market and rebadge it.
Yeah, it's a little different.
So it's a bit different over there. So I think the risk itself, frankly, is, at least from my perspective, I don't really have much evidence to back this up. I just haven't seen it, is really low. But then the second question is around the benefit. And that's why I was saying earlier on, I think the benefit really depends on what you're doing. Because if the consumers of what you're doing, there's always going to be a benefit to humanity to open sourcing hardware. And we all support that. But open sourcing hardware is a somewhat expensive process to initiate on. And if your expectation here is you're going to get a battalion of community members contributing to that, I just don't think that's accurate for most companies, with the exception of companies that are focusing on.
I know the word community is fantastic, but I don't even know that the word community needs to be involved here. From a business perspective, there's a real viable and tangible monetary benefit to having all of your hardware, including cases, chassis, boards, everything, full schematics published out there.
And what is the monetary business value of open source?
I think there'd be more open source hardware if that were the case.
But no, see, this is the thing. And if I were to say, let's make, I don't know, this little audio breakout box I've got next to me, right? Okay. I make that, ship it out. Good. Sales do well for 2 or 3 years. It's time for me to move on to something next because sales are slowly dwindling. There's still an existing user base out there. I don't want to have to support them anymore with new hardware. Now that it's all public, it's entirely possible, if the user base is at least a little bit decently large, for someone to come along, build a mom and pop shop out of both repairing, replacing parts for those particular units. You've then alleviated the need for certain kinds of support internally within your organization.
But I think we're talking about two separate things, though. The componentization of things, I would agree, because the idea of getting new parts and fixing them in the same way.
But if they're open, you don't need to worry about sourcing the components anymore.
But what I'm saying, I think there is a difference between a modularized piece of hardware, because I think there was always benefits then because people can do repairs and stuff like that. Totally agree. Yep. But in terms of the openness of the hardware itself, the openness of the chips, the openness of the PCBs, the architecture, I think there is a very, very minor general consumer benefit or business value towards that. I just don't think
you're modular, but you're not open, then it's pointless. Because unless you can come in there and replace a module with it, with something that can be produced in the current day, then what's the point of it having been modular? So you need to have it open in order for modularity to actually function in the long term in a viable way.
I think you make a great point about like PCs, right? You can plug in different graphics cards and stuff like that. They're not integrated components, right? The idea that you could take, you know, with your audio breakout box as an example, right? There'll be a DSP in there. If you could then take that DSP, take it out and put another one in there, from a different company. Or I absolutely agree with you on the value of that. But for the development of open designs, which I think is what we typically associate with open hardware, I just don't see as much of a benefit.
I certainly think there's a niceness benefit. If you open source the, for instance, the chassis, right? The 3D printing guidelines or whatever you use to print the plastic box that the thing comes in, right? That's great. Right. If you bought one of these things and you drop it on the floor and want to 3D print a new case, or it's great for someone who sets up a little mum and dad shop or who wants to make a small business doing cases in blaze orange for your little audio breakout box. What I'm not seeing is where the financial benefit to the original creating company comes from.
Right.
I'm not sure there is one. That doesn't necessarily make it a bad idea. I think if it's revenue neutral and you've got the choice between doing a nice thing or not doing a nice thing, you ought to do a nice thing.
No. I'm not sure there's a massively compelling
argument other than the ethical one for doing this. And the ethical one has had little to no
sense. It could actually have a negative impact, because if someone buys your audio breakout box, hear me out. Conceivably, you could have someone buys the audio breakout box. It breaks, so they take it into someone to get repaired. They then go and buy some kind of knocked off, non-certified component because it's open.
Happens all stick the it into time the box, in closed
and
systems.
It doesn't
it
work
happens
well.
All the time.
So then, what happens is the consumer then calls the company who's now sunsetted the hardware. And
literally,
support.
That scenario happens every day a billion times with closed hardware right now, especially in the audio industry, which you are very well aware of. So that example,
yeah, you're not
be
switching out components inside the closed hardware
all the time. It literally happens constantly. It is a constant thing. And if things were open, things could be at least, you could at least build things to spec. You could replace things with theoretically identical components.
But then consumers you'd need to certify the hardware.
Not if you don't necessarily have to support it. If you're the company that made the original piece.
If I build an audio breakout box, I componentize the hardware, and then I'm going to just let anyone go off and build their own kind of ramshackle interpretation of the spec.
Yeah, that ends
it's going to be bollocks. It's going to be a nightmare, and then it's going to be a giant stream of support issues.
I ought to point out what you've just described is the open source world, right? The whole point is that you put a spec out there and someone's allowed to build a ramshackle version if they like. That's what open means.
That's the whole friggin' point.
I agree with you. I'm not talking about the value of it being open. What I'm talking about is the support implication for the company.
Is significantly better than if it's a fully closed system. Significantly. As someone who's built and sold hardware commercially for at least a couple of years, this would have been way easier had things been completely open, not just from the company I was working for, but the companies we worked with. It would have been easier for us. It would have been cheaper for us, even if we were doing all the initial work ourselves. Just from a support perspective, it would have been a better idea. And looking at it realistically, from the benefits to you as a company, it's the same sort of benefits that the people like Cory Doctorow and myself get from the PR boost of being open. That means you get a million open warriors behind you pushing your stuff forward. Now, if you're coming out with a brand new little piece of hardware that's kind of a niche thing and no one's ever heard of you before, you're not going to get noticed. And to Jeremy's point, that's the biggest danger. If no one notices you, you're not making any money. So what was the point of existing in the first place? Wow. So you need to get an army behind you. And this is an amazing way to do it. And it works profoundly well.
Here is an interesting thing. What Brian just said there, you get the sort of people who like the idea that you have open hardware, you get that community on board by having open hardware. Yes. One, the interesting thing is this. Kyle says right at the end of his email, do you think, quoting something that was read out earlier, do you think making the source files harder to get or even making them not open source until delivery would be disingenuous? The point being, I don't think they were talking about keeping this closed forever. They were talking about maybe keeping it closed until they delivered the hardware and then being open. And to my mind, if you're going to open them eventually, you ought to open them from the beginning, because otherwise you run the risk that the open, that the we like open hardware community will decide not to get on board through some tiny deviation from doctrine. Like, you didn't publish the hardware, you didn't publish the specs until, you know, you kept them secret for 2 weeks. That means you're basically just as bad as Apple. So we're not going to get on board with you.
I don't know. I think, so 2 points here. The first thing is, you know, the point about, like your point, Brian, about getting, you know, the open community, the free culture community behind you, I totally agree with. That's why I think, again, it depends on the company or the organization. So as a practical example, Mycroft, right? Mycroft from day one, open source, open hardware, the whole deal. And they've got the open source community behind them. Like, we all think it's brilliant and we love what they're doing, right? I think that then if you were to compare it to someone like Samsung or Sony, it probably wouldn't make a dent in the sand having the open source community behind them. They just don't care as much. It's not as critical to their success. The second thing is, in terms of like whether you open them up at the beginning or at the end, again, I think it depends on what your outcome is. Like, to me, a company that, let's say a games console maker, let's say Nintendo, right? If Nintendo would basically, when they stop selling the Nintendo Entertainment System, if they basically made all of the hardware designs completely open, as best they could with any patents and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they basically said, you know what? We will not support you at all from now on. The support for all Nintendo Entertainment System related products is completely over. Don't come knocking to us. But everything's open now. Go knock yourself out. I think that would be amazing.
Why because don't more companies do that as they sell the next generation of hardware? Because it seems to me like that would sell more of their products in the long run. So I'm confused why more companies don't do that.
Major reason number one why companies don't do it is that they just reflexively, organizationally don't open stuff. And the second reason is it's almost always not entirely their thing to open. Here's the open source schematics for half of the Xbox. But you can't have the rest of it because that's a bunch of cards.
Because they licensed it from NVIDIA and Intel.
Right? Well, that is the case in a lot. But even opening what you have, I think, would get a lot of people behind your product and behind your company. It would really increase the value of your brand, as they say.
Yes.
But in perfect a meaningful, long-term, there. Systemic way.
A good example, Raspberry Pi. Right, it's not completely open. It uses some binary blobs in the kernel for the GPU core and that kind of thing. But it's mostly open, it's well documented, it's well spec'd, it runs open source. One of the interesting things, since I mentioned the PS3, there is an excellent talk from the Chaos Congress three, four years ago, might even be longer than that now, about the people who hacked the PS3 to run Linux. Right? And they basically talk every year about how someone's got some console to run Linux. Right? And the PS3 took loads longer than all the rest, but not because it was significantly harder, because when Sony shipped it, they said you can put Linux on it. So no one bothered to hack it. The point is, once you've cracked the security on it in order to be able to run Linux, you can also use that to run pirated games and homebrew, right? And it's the pirated games that's the important thing. It's the party games that are the important thing from Sony's point of view, Muppet.
I was with you. I just didn't want to say anything because I wanted to let it stand.
Most out of context comment ever, right? Shut up.
Snip that one out, listeners.
But this is the point. So obviously, console manufacturers are against the idea of people hacking stuff to run Linux because you end up breaking the security to do so, and then people can run pirated games. When Sony shipped the PS3, you could run Linux on it. There was a known, documented way of doing it. You didn't get access to half the Wizzy Games hardware, but that didn't matter. You could still run Linux. So none of the Linux people got involved. It was just pirates trying to hack it who basically aren't as good at technology, right? So you got mod chips, but no software hacks. Then Sony closed off, said you can't run Linux anymore, but they came up with the PS3 Slim. And they said it was a hardware problem. It was all, in fact, lies, and Linux ran on it fine. So then the Linux people got involved in order to break the security, and now they've done it, pirated games. But the point, it was put off for ages because you opened up enough to stop the open source market seeing you as the bad side. seeing you as the enemy, you know. So, yeah, there are some rabid lunatics who won't use a Raspberry Pi because it's not completely open. But in practice, it's done a good job. People are like, yeah, wow, that's great. That's much more open than some of the competition. I'll use a Raspberry Pi. It's well documented. Lots of people use it. And I think this is a similar kind of idea. What you're looking for is to avoid reasons that are going to cause people to see you as the enemy and open up enough that people will embrace what you're doing. But you don't necessarily have to be absolutely clean and absolutely to doctrine, you know?
I think the other thing as well is there are some markets with huge amounts of fans. So, for example, gaming, right? I mean, people are still so nostalgic over the NESes and SNESes and whatever else. And I just think that if Nintendo or Sony or whoever else opened up their specs, then you would keep all that momentum going around those platforms from years ago. I don't understand, like, to Jeremy's point, like, I don't understand why they don't do this anymore. But, well, I'm not sure if we answered your question.
I suspect we have not.
But we gave it a shot.
I don't think Carl Berezin was sent us the email with the hope that we'd go, here is the answer, give him one sentence, and then close the segment. What you've got is a bunch of opinions, and there will no doubt be a whole bunch more opinions on community.badvantage.org. So if you have thoughts on when people should open source hardware, when they shouldn't open source hardware, which thing, if you were building it, would you think, no, you know what, I'm keeping that secret? Which do you think ought to be kept secret by other companies? Are you more towards the Brian end of the world, where everything ought to be open and there are good reasons for that? Or are you more towards the Sony end of the world who don't think this?
And also, Kyle, send us one of your open MYR ESP8266 thingies and we'll do a review.
Yeah, and as I say, before we finish, we should say kudos for releasing it as open source and keeping it open source. And yes, good luck with the Kickstarter, which is still going. I think there's a week or so left to go.
Ah, so there we go. We have another show in the can. Thank you for listening, people. This is, it turns out, it was brought to the attention of all of the presenters that we're about to, have we hit it yet? Or
nope,
we're about to hit it.
We haven't less than a week away. Yet. Yep, it's a week to go until our 3-year anniversary. First show came out on the 24th of October, 2013.
Right.
This show was released on the 20th of October, 2016, assuming I don't break the upload script and Jono actually does his job for the first time in about 2 months. That would be excellent.
it's also encouraging as well to me that two things are consistent with Bad Voltage. One is that at the beginning of our run of Bad Voltage, we were accused of probably pod fading. And last week, we were accused of probably pod fading.
We were,
as well,
yeah. So. I find it disappointing that Joe Ressington is apparently rest fading, but there you go.
Well, I missed the second pod fade. Who accused us of pod fading the second time?
Joe did, from Linux Luddites. Although that's possibly just because we haven't bothered to ship a C90 cassette tape with the show on to him. Well, actually, being serious, I have here on my desk, showing to the other presenters. Oh, where's the camera?
You got one.
I did. Look, this is an actual cassette tape of a recorded show by the System AU guys. They recorded a cassette tape and sent it to people. It's wicked. It took me 6 months to find an opportunity to play it, because have you got a tape player? I've got a tape player.
I do not know many people left with a cassette player.
Record players
all over the place. Cassette players. I've probably know more people with an 8-track player than cassette players.
It's got it's basically one of their shows, essentially, right? It's got some music
that's
on there,
so cool.
and some conversation, and there's a weird sped up bit and stuff like that. And whoever it is, who does the little intro voice for the show. It's System AU, right. and brilliant voice. Whoever it is who does it, I'm super impressed with them for having the movie trailerist of movie trailer voices. It's really, really good. But yes, anyway. You should listen to System AU.
One of the things I love about that, I met the System AU guys when I was at LCA.
Oh, really? Cool.
And they're just Yeah, they're absolutely, as you might imagine, they're just so much fun to hang out with. They were great. And they gave me one of those cassette tapes. And I'm sure you guys are the same. I get so much crap when I go to conferences and almost all of it goes in the bin. But that's just so different and unique. I kept it.
It is.
It's in the other room, but I just think it's brilliant what they did.
We got to start pressing Victrola or something and give them out at conferences. We got to up the bar.
We do. We'll have a big wax cylinder with the Bad Voltage logo on it.
Bad Voltage wax cylinder coming soon.
/ get involved. Absolutely. That's the best idea we've had in ages. Let's do that. But yes, so that was the show.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
It was a show. Just a quick note. If any of you are going to be at All Things Open next week, in Raleigh, which is this great conference put on by a great team, Todd and Co. Jeremy and I are both going to be out there. So if you're listening to the show, be sure to come over and say hello.
Is Brian there as well?
I don't think Brian's going.
Right, okay. I'm not, but he's on the other side of the ocean.
I don't think so, no.
So we're going to be there all week. Thanks to Red Hat for sending us out.
Yeah.
Because we're out with the opensource.com people. So
why?
It's going to be a good time.
Why are Red Hat sending you out?
Red Hat's not sending us out, actually.
Oh.
Opensource.com is.
Right. Basically, opensource.com is this open source. For those of you who are not familiar with opensource.com, is basically a website with loads of open source articles and news. It's sponsored by Red Hat, but the team are pretty independent in how they operate it. They have a group called moderators, which are not like forum moderators, just basically people who create content and help with the site. I joined about just over a year ago. Jeremy joined recently, and then they have basically a moderator meeting once a year at All Things Open. I think this is actually going to be the second one. I think they ended it for the first time last time. And they basically file the moderators out. So
that sounds cool.
It's really cool. Ack, you should write some content for him. You're a good writer.
Carve out a space in all of my copious free time that isn't taking stuff out of cardboard boxes constantly.
Castle language has changed. It's in a new place.
It is. Yes, I have moved, packed up all my stuff, moved about a third of a mile down the road and then unpacked it all again.
Did you just walk down the street with your couch, or did you actually hire movers or move it yourself?
I hired movers. Not only did I hire movers, I'll dig up a picture from somewhere. I took a picture of the van they arrived in, which was this gargantuan truck. And I'm looking at the window going, you see your truck? Oh, you can move Buckingham Palace with this thing. You're aware I've got a two-bedroom flat, right? And so they ended up sending it away. Then they had to bring in a Luton van and everything. It was all, total nightmare. But the move happened in the end, thank God. And last night, we unpacked the final box. Which had books in.
Glory.
I've still got a million cardboard boxes. They're just all empty. So if you know anyone who needs any cardboard boxes before tomorrow when they all go in the recycling, shout quickly.
It reminds me of when you told me that you moved somewhere years ago or you moved in before Sam, that's Axe's ex-wife, and all he had was like a computer and a kettle or something.
When we moved out, actually, is what that was. That was moving out of the house in North Walsham. We had to move everything out, but I had to stay behind for a week or so and I needed to work and things. So I had a computer and a blow-up mattress on the floor and a carrier bag that was hung out the window, which had things like butter in it so it would stay cold, and that was it. But it was this real kind of, imagine no possessions, nomadic existence. And I found myself by the end of the week thinking, do you know what? I could live like this. This is all right,
The realization that you own too much stuff hits you in a situation like that.
There is. I heard someone once say that you don't own anything unless you can carry it while you're running as fast as you can, firing a rifle over your shoulder at whatever's chasing you. I'm not sure I'd go quite that far. But having lived like that for a week, you sort of think, do you know what? Do I really need all of this stuff? And especially after you've unpacked the 4,309th box, you'll find yourself thinking, do I really need this premium gold edge collection of delivery plates? No, I don't. Right.
When I moved When I moved from England to America and I got rid of all my stuff and just shipped over my music gear, it was the most cathartic experience ever. Because it's true, I was like, I'd look at all my stuff and it was a nightmare cleaning that stuff out. And I thought, do I need this? And I was thinking, no. Do I want it? Yes.
do I need it?
No.
No, don't need it.
Very different things. So, well, congratulations on the move, Mr. Langlois. Yeah, happy that you're in your... the dream of the flat has been alive for a long time, so good to see
it. It has. We are now in. I still haven't wired everything in properly, but we're getting there, so that's all cool. And I can actually record. And part of the nice thing about it is all I need to do is just the microphone. I can just pick it up and move it to the other part of my desk now, rather than having to disassemble my desk in order to have room to put the microphone on it. It's just, I've got all this room. Look, I can reach out like this. It's marvellous.
Wow. So we're not going to hear your bloody PC fan in future episodes.
Well, although you seem to be positioned in the exact same place in the flat as you were last time. So you love your computer to be directly in front of the kitchen.
Well, you know, it's the way the thing works, right? It's not that different to the old flat, the new flat. Apart from the fact, well, I was going to say I own it, but apart from the fact that the bank own it. So.
You know, I, speaking of which, I went to Vancouver last week to go and see a band, and I was staying with a friend of mine, Acknos in Randall Ross, member of the Ubuntu, he works at Canonical.
He does.
And he has got the definition of a bachelor pad. His living room, he's basically got a giant projector screen up, and he got this some kind of special projector where you don't have to put it as far back, so you can have like a really big picture and it's not too far away from the screen. He's got like, you know, he's got like blankets hanging from the side. So it looks like a theater, full surround sound system in there. Bloody loud. 80 bottles of bourbon on shelves in that room. And then he's got another room, which has basically got about 60 keyboards in it. I've never seen anything like it. Music keyboards.
Music keyboards. Right, okay.
Yeah. His kitchen. He showed me his freezer. He opened his freezer. He's like, do you want me to show you how much of a bachelor pad this is? I was like, yeah, he opened up his freezer, nothing in there but glasses chilling for drinks. He had 20 bottles of rum in his kitchen. I've never seen anything like it. I was like, how can I move in?
So, what we have for dinner tonight? Nachos, same as every night. So, wow. Yeah,
all right, no. I guess we should probably wrap it up.
We should. Yep. Yes, so we should be back, all four of us again. Hooray, hopefully.
Yes. In a few weeks.
Have a good time. We will see you after our 3rd year anniversary.
Yes.
Bye.
Glorious. Bye.